I want to talk about trusting your higher wisdom. I think most people, when they think about Buddhism, wisdom is associated somehow with that idea. But we have some pretty lofty ideas of what wisdom is. We think in terms of the village elder who is able to decide things in a way that fully resolves the problem and to come up with a resolution that other people can't think of because they're just not that wise. They have some inscrutable knowledge and ability to avoid the wrong conclusions. And so there's also a component of sensitivity to the ultimate needs of the beings involved. This image has two important misunderstandings to it. And one is that this idealized person has a unique ability to be right. And the other is that that person isn't you. You know, you're here, you're giving up some time on a Sunday evening to practice meditation and to explore the Dharma. And like most people think, wisdom is involved. It's deeply involved. It is at the heart of two of the numbered lists of things that Buddha taught about right at the beginning of his teaching. The Eightfold Path is divided into three sections. And the first one is the wisdom section. And it just has two things: right understanding and right intention. And right understanding has to do with the other list, which is the Four Noble Truths. And to boil it down, right understanding means it's about suffering and the end of suffering. And in there is that the cause of suffering is clinging. And I apologize about boiling it down, because you can spend the rest of your life exploring suffering and what it is and how it works and how to end it, because we're always denying it. We're always trying to push it out of our awareness. We're trying to soothe it or cover it over or disguise it somehow. And we don't even know we're doing that. And as long as we're doing that, we're not going to address it. We're not going to untie the knot that attaches it to us. And we're going to live with it. So the Eightfold Path is the solution to the problem of suffering, the way to end it. The other aspect, the other fold of the Eightfold Path that comes under the heading of wisdom, is right intention. And that is the intention to do it, to end the suffering, to follow the Eightfold Path and use it and bring suffering to an end. Therefore, there's nothing inscrutable or mysterious about Buddhist wisdom. You have the sensitivity to all beings' ultimate need, which is to not suffer. Buddha said, all beings want to be happy. We desire it. We desire to end the suffering of all beings. And we know how to do it, because we have the Eightfold Path. We have the teachings. So we're wise. Ta-da! The way wisdom works is not mystical. There's nothing mysterious or magical about it. In fact, it's a very simple function of discerning one thing from another. So, the first time we ever meditate, we discern my attention was sent to the breathing, and it's not there. You discern the difference between paying attention to the breathing and designing a bicycle or a helicopter or planning a dinner or whatever wherever the mind goes. You recognize that's not breathing. So that's discernment. It's very elemental level in our practice. About a year later, a year of meditating fairly regularly, what we're usually able to discern is that the attention keeps going to planning. This is something we've come to know about our minds. And that planning is usually a cover-up for fear. Different people, it's different, but that's pretty common, actually. And that we're able to recognize that we know how to investigate fear. We know what to do with it. That we keep the attention on the somatic sensations, the experience in the body of fear, drawing the attention away from the story that the mind keeps wanting to tell, because the mind thinks that's going to keep us from experiencing the fear. So in other words, what we're doing is we're breaking the habit of the mind to keep us from looking at our suffering. Because we have to in order to end it. And when we do sit with that bodily experience of fear, it gets processed. If we sit with the bodily experience of fear and the mental story of what we're afraid of, which doesn't exist now, hasn't yet happened, that's the nature of fear, it's a projection into the future. If we sit with the two things going, we're just torturing ourselves. Buddha likens it to standing next to a raging, out-of-control fire, throwing wood on it. Just keeps it going, making it worse. So get the attention away from that story onto the actual suffering, bringing a loving attention to that, the immediate experience of suffering. And that loving attention is the most healing thing that we have in our human experience. We feel it when other people pay attention to us when we're suffering. It's like a balm. How much more powerful it is when it's our own attention, because it's right there. There's no separation at all. So as the fear is processed, discernment shows us there's another level and another level. And ding, the sitting is over, and next time, maybe it'll come again and we'll go deeper. Maybe not. Maybe next time, planning through the whole session. 10 years later, we are able to discern the way the sense of self attaches the mind to the thoughts and impulses that cause suffering. and to recognize it as it arises. So the wisdom grows, this ability to discern, to spot things. And as I mentioned before I started the Dharma talk, we can discern, and you all have, when you're not satisfied with your meditation. Now, sometimes you're dissatisfied with things that are perfectly normal. So it's a great idea to talk to another experienced meditator so that they can tell you, that's okay, don't worry about that. Or they've been through something similar and can tell you what they've tried. You try it. If it doesn't work, find a teacher. Find somebody with more experience. And keep trying. It's really hard to make a serious mistake with meditation. So recognizing that every time you discern what's going on in your mind, you are developing wisdom. You can trust your own inclination about how to do your practice. And I think in our conversation before the talk started, it became kind of clear that the most important thing about meditating isn't how you do it, but just to do it. Just do it. And an old adage is, if when we have our sitting, we have one moment of mindfulness, the whole sitting is worthwhile, no matter what else goes on in there. The suttas talk about this function of wisdom as discernment. The Mahavidala Sutta, a visitor came to Buddha's Sangha and asked Sariputta, and I don't know if you've heard that name much, but he was sort of like the star monk of the original Sangha. This visitor asked Sariputta, to what extent is one said to be one of poor discernment? Sariputta said, one who doesn't discern this is stress, doesn't discern this is the origination of stress, doesn't discern this is the cessation of stress, or this is the practice leading to the cessation of stress. So in other words, this is our task. This is what this function of wisdom is for, is watching the mind and just saying, as I suggested in the instructions during our meditation today, when you notice that something has grabbed your attention and held it, notice how you're feeling. Discernment. What are the somatic feelings in the body? And discern, is this suffering? Most likely, it is going to be. It might be very subtle, very low-grade suffering. But just discern it, that suffering has arisen. And then, as I mentioned before, after you do this a while, you begin to get to know your own patterns, and then you're able to see where that came from and what will end it and how to go about ending it. And people always say, and I've heard this at least 100 times, but I thought in meditation we're not supposed to think. That applies to discursive thought, the kind of thinking that's like subvocal narrative of a story, telling a story. There's a kind of momentum to it, a cohesiveness to it. Discernment is nonverbal. It may be preverbal. It's like a collection of recognitions. It's just a movement of the mind seeing what is. And Buddha talks about this a lot. He says, to really see things as they are. That's what he's talking about. This recognition, this discernment of what's going on. Not just, oh, it feels really nice, I'm not thinking anything right now, except I'm thinking about not thinking anything. But, yep, there's a very subtle thought about whether or not I'm thinking. Oh, I notice a very subtle disapproval of myself for having thought about not thinking. That's what I'm talking about. It's a little like we're snorkeling in the mind. You know, when you first start snorkeling, you have to fuss with the gear. You know, you have to learn how to move and stay still in the water, and you have to deal with how to breathe. Very much like meditation, actually, when you think about it. And then when you get all that kind of taken care of, and you're in the water, and you look around, and it's, wow, there's all this stuff going on. And some of it I don't like. And a whole lot of it I don't understand. And what do I do with it all? And am I in any kind of danger? Does anybody remember that kind of a reaction the first time they looked into their mind? So it takes a while. It takes a while. And also it helps to recognize that it's pretty common to be freaked out when you first start meditating. It's a wild mind in there. We just, you know, we haven't done anything with it since we were born. So after a while, we're able to see, okay, those are fish. That looks like coral. That's a snail, clam, or whatever. And things begin to have meaning that we can recognize. And the same thing happens as we explore our minds through meditation. And eventually, you know, listening to Dharma talks, we begin to learn the names of things. And we hear or read suttas about what they do, how they affect us, how we should deal with them. It's important to know that we're discerning. Discern that we're discerning. There's a brilliant Buddhist scholar named Nyanaponika Thera who says, the Buddha teaches that life can be correctly understood only if three basic facts are understood. And these basic facts are anicca, anatta, and dukkha. Anicca, that everything is always changing. Anatta is that nothing has a solid, fixed, or reliable reality. And dukkha, as a result, we're dissatisfied with our experience. Because we're always trying to get things just the way we like them, and everything is changing. Nothing has a substance that we can hold on to. This understanding of these three basic characteristics of life must take place not only logically, but in confrontation with our own experience. Insight, wisdom, or vipassana, which is the ultimate liberating factor in Buddhism, consists in just this experiential understanding of the three characteristics as applied to one's own bodily and mental processes and deepened and matured in meditation. Most of the people that I know have come to meditation because they wanted to reduce their stress. And then they're told, oh no, you have to study your stress. And, you know, they just wanted to have a calm mind. So there's a sutta on calm mind called the Samadhi Sutta, or Discourse on Tranquility and Insight, Samatha versus Vipassana. The sutta says that both a calm mind and discernment are vital. In this sutta, Buddha said, the individual who has attained internal tranquility of awareness, a calm mind, but not insight into phenomena through heightened discernment, should approach an individual who has attained insight into phenomena and ask him, how should fabrications be regarded? And fabrications is all that stuff we see in our minds when we finally look in there. And the other will answer in line with what he has seen and experienced. Fabrications should be regarded in this way. They should be investigated in this way. They should be seen in this way with insight. Then eventually, the first person will become one who has attained both internal tranquility of awareness and insight into phenomena through heightened discernment. It's basically what I just said a few minutes ago. If your higher wisdom, your discernment, doesn't answer the question for you, go ask somebody. Eventually, this, with a lot of repetition, that sutta says, we need both. We need the calm mind, and we need this searching, observing, discerning mind too, in order to free ourselves from suffering. When I went through the training at Zen Hospice Project, they told us to trust our intuition in dealing with people who are suffering a lot. And I thought they were crazy. I wanted to know how to answer the questions that the patients are going to ask me. And fortunately, they didn't do that. The people who did the training basically told us what I've told you. Watch how you feel. Notice what causes you to feel that way and what will end the suffering. And be aware of that as you do this work. And understand it's about ending suffering. And within that framework, you will intuitively know the best way to approach it, the best way for you to approach it. I kept a journal for the 5 years that I did hospice work, and I've gone back to it and looked it over and second-guessed a lot of decisions that I made. But, you know, I have to say, overall, judging by the way it seemed to leave people feeling, I did a pretty good job trusting my higher wisdom. This has taken me a lot longer than I expected it would, so I'm going to leave out the part where we're supposed to do discernment even in the very deepest of concentration and say, we're lay people. We're probably not going to go that route where we're looking for the sense of self when we have no sense of perception or time. But we're going to use our discernment in the cauldron of sudden events and ferocious emotion on a daily basis. And we need to trust it. Not that, you know, we're receiving some kind of communique from on high. The Martians aren't giving us infallible instructions. But that if we have been using discernment with a calm mind, we have probably developed a pretty good sense of the best way for us in that situation to minimize the suffering for all beings concerned. Thank you.